So I believe the 80-20 rule has gotten referenced before on the show, but I think it's going to be important here. It's the Pareto principle, which states that 20% of inputs are responsible for 80% of results. And if you're looking for those kind of levers or force multipliers in marketing, then I think you should really consider rich media like audio and video, right? So if that sounds great, or if it seems too hard, then I think this episode is going to be really valuable to you. I think you might learn that you can have your cake and eat it too. Nom, 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 nom.
What is the DNA of business marketing? How do we market ourselves now and in the future? Brand communications is evolving. Are you? Let's explore together. Spiral upwards. This is Spiral Marketing.
Josh Bellhumer's passion began as a child, tinkering with HTML, deconstructing his favorite sites and building new sites. By the time he could drive, he was a successful freelance developer, and just a few years later, he became a lead developer at Brink in Tucson. Over time, Josh has melded his marketing education with his technical experience and has spearheaded the efforts to develop Brink into a full-service digital agency. In 2011, Josh opened the doors to Brink's first expansion office here in DC, and is leading the charge in Brink's continued ascension toward the upper echelons of creative agencies. Josh, welcome to the show, man.
It's a pleasure to be here. And that's a very arrogant last sentence of that bio. I didn't realize that.
Oh, it's epic drama.
Our ascension. It sounds like we're angelic. One day we will be the gods of marketing.
Oh, it's perfect. Elevation's good. I like to play with elevation myself. Oh. So we are sitting here in this room, which, if you're watching this video, then you're already getting a taste. If not, then I think it's important. Josh, can you describe a little bit about what's going on in this room?
Sure. So we are on a row house on U Street in DC. And the bottom floor of this row house is broken up into two spaces. The front is where our team works, our DC team works. It's where we have our client meetings and everything like that. We have the back of this space that we really didn't know what to do with for years. We've been in the space for about 5 years now. And just the beginning of this year, we had an epiphany of what we should really be doing with this space. And so we went out and we bought some equipment and we started working on putting together what we now describe as the Brink Social Studio.
Nice.
And so that's where we're at, is the Social Studio. Okay. And the whole idea behind the studio is being able to do quick, rapid content production, a variety of different types of content pieces, photography, video, stop motion, podcasts, as we're doing now.
Good idea.
Exactly. And I think this is our first official podcast that will be on iTunes as well as in video format. So
beautiful.
We appreciate the opportunity to do that.
Absolutely. It's an honor. Well, that was going to be my second question. What's the vision behind it? I guess maybe this will meld well with this question, which is, what led you to fulfill that vision? What brought you to build this studio?
Well, I think when we talk about vision, we put it in the context of a market opportunity, right? I've been in DC now for almost 7 years. And in that time, I've noticed that there's a lot of content opportunity that's been growing over time as social media rose to what it became. But the city's kind of far behind. It's lagging behind in keeping up with that. So if you're a PR firm or a public affairs firm or a lobbyist even,
right?
I think it's a $13 billion industry here in the city. You need to recognize that setting up meetings with decision makers and pitching reporters isn't where it ends anymore. There's one more component, and that's reaching out directly to the constituents on a grassroots basis, and that's done through social media. If you want to get a piece of legislation passed, or you want to fundraise, or you want to get people to sign a petition, or whatever the action is, you need to go directly to those people and have a conversation with them and get them engaged. You can't rely on going through reporters and traditional media anymore.
Sure.
So that ties back into this ability to produce good quality content and quick content. And that's something that DC is lacking. There's definitely a few good content agencies here that are mostly focused on the marketing side. There's some PR firms that you can tell they kind of get it, but they're not really making the moves they need to make. In a lot of cases, they're just outsourcing to people like us because they're not able to do it in-house. But there's not a lot of people here or agencies or organizations that are able to do quick social content, and in particular, application of that advocacy setting. And so that was the vision, being able to see an opportunity. Of course, in this current day and age, you have somebody like Trump who is causing a lot of anger or emotion or however you want to put it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of groups interested in activating people to react to that emotion or react to that action that Trump may take. So sure. Let's say Trump tweets something offensive, right? Mm-hmm. If we're able to turn around a video piece commenting on his tweet within 3 or 4 hours of him making that tweet, then we're going to be ahead of everybody else in actually participating in that conversation. If you're relying on a marketing agency to go out and spec and have a producer rate and a production crew and put together a plan of action and storyboard and script it and then schedule a shoot and do the shoot and then post-production, edit it, get it all together and put it out, it's not going to make sense. You can't comment on his tweet a week later.
Right.
Like, you have to be able to do it right away. So that's ultimately the vision of being able to do it rapidly, do it cheap enough that you can do it continuously rather than having to wait and pick and choose the exact moments you want to do it. And doing it at a high enough quality where you're elevating that content game. You're not just sending off a quick tweet or a really low quality iPhone video, but you're doing something that's well produced.
Love it. Love it. Nimble, quick, and visually rich, interactive media. Do you consider video interactive media?
Yeah, I mean, video is usually facilitated through an interactive setting, I would say.
Right.
And we actually toy around a little bit with more interaction with video. Mm-hmm. For example, one of our clients in the last few years was Families USA, who's a healthcare advocacy group. They were one of the co-writers of Obamacare.
Oh.
And this was just before the election, when there was still an environment, a toxic environment around Obamacare, and they were trying to do a little bit to change perceptions around that. Of course, you know, things didn't go well after Election Day, and so now we're in a completely new environment. But let's rewind the clock and think about when Obama was still president. Democrats still had a little bit more power, and they wanted to do what they could to activate their current supporters and get them to be a little bit more educated on the benefits of Obamacare. And in particular, it was about the subsidies that were necessary for low-income people.
Okay.
In order to keep Obamacare afloat. And part of this was around this environment with the King v. Burwell Supreme Court case. They were ruling on whether the states could opt out of the subsidies with Obamacare. So that was the environment we're in. And what we did is we went to a bunch of different people's apartments and houses across the country, mm-hmm. over like a 1 week period with a 2-person crew. And we shot interviews with these people. And talking about how before Obamacare, they didn't have coverage or they couldn't afford coverage. After Obamacare and after the subsidies, they could. Some people unequivocally said, I would be dead if I didn't have Obamacare.
Wow.
So it was really powerful stories. And out of that, we cut together a 10-minute documentary piece, which was, I think, you know, a little bit of a bold choice in deciding, you know, let's do something a little more long form. We're in an environment where everybody feels like everything has to be quick. But sometimes those 10-minute or 20-minute or even 30-minute pieces do really well. We always point to that Kony 2012 video that was like one of the biggest viral videos that year, and it was a 35-minute piece. So people will sit through good content. But anyways, going back to the point about interactivity, we made this documentary, and then what we did is we integrated into the documentary a custom player that we put on a microsite, and we had what we called popcorn elements, which were elements that were triggered at certain time signatures. And most of the elements were like tweetable content pieces. So somebody would say something somewhat profound, we'd be able to actually have a pop-up right next to their head, an exact quote, like, wow. Without Obamacare, I would be dead. And then you could click a button and tweet that out or share it on Facebook right there and then. And we saw that out of the people that watched at least 15 seconds of the documentary, one out of six shared it on social media using one of those popcorn helmets.
That's so cool.
Yeah, so it got really good engagement. So that's an example of if you take video to that interactive level, which I still think there's a lack of good tools for that, and there should be, and maybe that's something we should be building out. But if you're fortunate enough to be able to afford somebody that could build you a custom player, then explore that kind of thing. And if not, do look for those tools. Something like YouTube does have the ability to add like hotspots within your video at different time signatures. So there's opportunities there to try to compel people to action in the middle of videos rather than just putting something at the end of the video that tells them to do something.
Well, that's a great tip right there. I think video is interactive from a variety of definitions of the word interactive, but I think increasingly we should be looking for more and more features to increase that interactivity.
Yeah.
But so that's a great tip in and of itself. What other insights do you think brand marketers from around the world could draw from this undertaking?
Well, I think there's certain, part of it is a mindset, right? And that mindset is understanding that content in the social age is a lot more disposable than it was in the pre-social age, we'll call it, right?
Sounds and, prehistoric.
Yeah, exactly. But I think there's, you'll find, especially here in DC, there's a lot of the video producers in this town come from a very old school broadcast background. Mm-hmm. And that's the mindset they bring into doing social content as well. And so this goes back to what I was saying before. You have a producer, you do location scouts, you put together a crew of six people, you know, where you have two grips and a boom operator, a mixer, two camera operators, a director, a DP. You know, you have all these different roles. You have to pack six different large bags of equipment, you know, versus trying to be lightweight and nimble. And I'll grant them that the video quality they're going to produce is going to be a slight level above what we can produce with a one-person crew with a single bag of equipment, right?
But all we need here is a Danny.
Yeah, exactly. And Danny is our on-staff producer, who right now he's running a four-camera shoot by himself while we're talking, which you'll be putting up on your blog and we'll put up on our blog. So being able to do that, you know, if you think of video quality on a scale of like 1 to 10, that social quality video that they produce is going to be something like an 8, and what we produce is going to be something like a 7. And it's not going to be that noticeable.
Especially if you consider 99% of the world and audience, A, they don't care. B, they don't have the training to detect the differences and maybe not even the screen to see the differences.
And that's the big key, right? And that ties into some of the other decisions you might make. I don't want to get too technical, but if you're shooting your video in like a 4K ProRes RAW file format, which is a file format that collects the most amount of data, right? So you get the best picture quality. But then what you're doing is when you're processing that data, there's a lot of rendering time. You have to buy large hard drives. It's hard to transfer it. Usually they have to drop a hard drive in the mail to send it to another location. You can't just throw it up on Dropbox because the files are just way too large. And then as you color correct them, you have to be in a program that requires a lot more time. And again, it goes into the rendering time. If you make the decision to just shoot it in the 1080p H.264, which is like the really standard format that you see on the web, when you go to YouTube and you watch a video, you're watching a 1080p H.264 video or Vimeo or Facebook.
Sure.
If you just shoot it in that from the start, it's a lot easier to edit it. You can do it a lot quicker. Rendering times are a lot less. You can transfer things by a Dropbox rather than by a hard drive. It speeds up the whole process. Yes, again, the quality is going to be slightly less, but the device they're looking at it on is their mobile phone, where that 1080p is going to look great. And they're never going to be looking at it at 4K. That's just going to eat up too much bandwidth anyways. Your video will play too slow. In a lot of cases, you want it to be 720p. You want it to be smaller. So if you're asking that, whether you're doing it yourself or you're asking that of like a video crew or a video guy or whoever you may have on staff, just always emphasizing that mindset of like, how can we make this quicker? Knowing that the content is a little bit disposable. You're not going to play it on TV. It's not going to be a Super Bowl ad. It's okay that it's not 4K, you know, highest quality possible.
In the not so distant future, people might be watching this on their watch.
Yeah, exactly. Trump might be watching it in his microwave. I don't know.
I love the idea of speed with this platform and the spirit of this conversation. And I think it goes right in line with the 80-20 rule, because if you want to get 80% of the results, then you really do need to move fast. So I think that hopefully people are nodding their heads as they listen to this, that yes, okay, trends are short, people's attention spans are short, and your window of opportunity is similarly short.
Mm-hmm. And there's statistics to back this up, but in my own experience, the number one driver of engagement I've seen in content has always been relevance. You can have a lot lower quality content if you're commenting on something that is relevant here and now and participating in conversations that are happening now, not commenting on things that happened a week ago or a month ago.
Right, absolutely. People are already on to the next thing. It's no longer on fleek, folks.
Yeah.
Remember that phrase? That's been gone for a long time. Oh, okay. So what have you learned so far from this undertaking?
Oh, well, I think that, you know, there was certainly a learning curve in figuring out, like, okay, so if we're throwing out the playbook of how to properly do video production with five-person crews and do it with a one-person crew.
Sure.
There's going to be certain learning curves, right? Every once in a while, we would find, like, you know, oh, we should have lit this a little differently, or we should have done this with the microphone set up. And those little lessons along the way make us better and better at it. I think there's a learning process everyone goes through. So really the tip out of that is produce. Don't just sit around and plan. Make stuff and don't be ashamed of it, you know, if it's not perfect quality. A lot of times we put up videos like on our Vimeo or our social media for ourselves, which is how we started, right? We shot stuff for ourselves before we charged people money to do it.
Makes sense. So,
yeah, we wanted to make sure we could do it well. We would still put it out there and get feedback and see how it performs, even if there were certain components of it that we didn't think were quite right. I think that was important, and it's something that I've always known to be true, that you should learn through doing rather than through planning. But when you're facing putting something out there that you're not 100% proud of, and the perfectionist in you wants to redo it and keep redoing it rather than just getting it out there, it's a tough decision. So that was something that, like I said, it has always been an ideology that I thought I practiced. But when my back was up against the wall and I had to follow through with it, I think it made me better as a marketer, because I was able to actually cross that bridge and prove that, okay, I can put stuff out there that I think is just okay, just to keep it moving and keep progressing.
Love it. I like that you mentioned you're back against the wall. There's nothing like urgency as a motivator, but I'm getting that your point about just getting in and doing and learning on the job is extremely valuable. And it must have been validating as well, because I'm sure you saw the quality go up.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And you also get new ideas. One of the things that we haven't explored as much that I want to explore is more live video. Mm-hmm. We have the equipment and the capacity to do it, but we haven't been playing around in that space too much, because that's a really scary thing to do if you feel like you can't do it perfect yet.
Right.
And maybe we should have shot this live. This might have been a good opportunity. But yeah, I think that's going to be the next like hurdle that we cross, and that, like, I'm confident saying we can do live, but just doing it consistently without being fully confident in the content or what you're doing just to practice is hard to do when you're talking live video.
That's fair. Yeah. That's an exciting challenge, maybe for the part two next time.
Yeah. And we, for a little background, we're headquartered in Tucson, and we have a bigger studio in Tucson. And out of there, we do a lot of live video. We actually run the public access television station for our city, for the city of Tucson.
Awesome.
Yeah. And so one of the challenges we set up for ourselves there was we wanted to do a nightly news show, nightly public access news show. So it's called 5 on 20. And we do it every night, Monday through Friday.
Wow.
And we have a whole volunteer of, you know, 18, mostly young people who want to get into video production. So they're rotating and learning all the different roles, from being anchors to running the teleprompter to running the switchboards and all of that. And doing that, like a live broadcast every night, I think has just taught us as a company so much that we've learned here in DC from that. And even the technical aspects of running video, live video, was something that, like, it was an 8-month process for us to get it perfectly working. It required a lot of different sysadmin brains and a lot of work. And I think for the average person, something like Facebook Live makes it a lot easier for you. When you're trying to do it at that level, it becomes a lot harder. And so I think that ties back to the philosophy of what we're trying to do here with the Social Studio, in that, you know, all that time investment that our Tucson studio had to put in to learn about the hardware and technical considerations of live video, we don't need to worry about that as much here, because we're going to use the tools that are available to us. And that includes like Facebook Live and YouTube Live and Periscope and, you know, these tools that are already there that make it a lot easier to work with.
Excellent. Is there a philosophical direction that hasn't been discussed? And what do you see as the future of this tech usage?
So philosophical is a strong word.
Okay.
No, but I do think one of the things we haven't discussed is the value of on-screen talent. Mm-hmm. And that's I think, our next opportunity that we're exploring ourselves. Of course, usually when a client hires us to do video, we're putting one of them on screen. They're the subject matter experts.
Sure.
A lot of times they do a great job. Mm-hmm. We've worked with government affairs departments that are part of associations. And like those people are usually lobbyists, trained lobbyists. And so they're great. They're personable and they're good in front of a camera. Mm-hmm. And we've also worked with like some startups, for example. And they usually do a pretty good job on camera because entrepreneurs tend to be very passionate about what they're selling, and they wouldn't have got funding if they couldn't talk to people, right?
That's interesting. So what have you found so far, that passion on camera is almost as effective as training?
Yeah, I think so. And I think some people have that, like there's that mental barrier when a camera's pointed at them, where even if they're great face to face, it goes away somehow.
Like a deer in the headlights a little bit.
Yeah. And so that's where some of like our skills have to come in as interviewers or producers, in making them feel comfortable, just like how you try to make me feel comfortable, you know, and easing into having a podcast. Mm-hmm. We have to identify when they're nervous or whatever the issue may be, and then figure out ways to very naturally talk them through it. It's digital, you know, we're not putting stuff on 35 millimeter film or anything like that. It's like, it's okay for us to keep the cameras running and just talk through it and try to get to that point where we're getting usable stuff.
Right.
And so that's like, anytime we ever think we're shooting like a 15 minute piece, it's always going to be scheduled as an hour block.
Sure.
And we may use that whole hour to get the good 15 minutes of material, but we want to make sure we have that leeway to talk them through it. But I think I got a little off track in tying back to what is the vision of on-screen talent. I think it's good that people be able to sell their own product. But if you're going to be doing like consistent content, let's say you're trying to do like a magazine or an advocacy channel on YouTube or whatever it may be, you may want to have some really good talent that looks great on screen. Mm-hmm. And so my vision, I think, for
like us, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're the example of why you want to get on screen talent.
Are the lights dim enough, guys? Just kidding.
But having that Rolodex, for lack of a better term, of people to go to, mm-hmm. is my next challenge. And I call it like the collective, right? The Brink Collective. Who's going to be our collective of content creators that we can go to whenever we need either on-screen talent, or animators is another good example. We can do animation in-house with some of our designers, but animation is such a like personal style,
sure.
where each of our designers has kind of their own style, and sometimes they can emulate other styles. But we may find that somebody with a very particular skill set in animating, maybe it's like a Pixar style, or animating like a really nice hand-drawn pencil style, like flipbook style, that will be appropriate for that specific project. You know, I don't think it's practical to have all those different styles on staff. So that's where you want to have like a network of people to go to, that you know what their rates are, you know how much they'll cost, and you can go to them anytime an opportunity comes and bring them as part of the crew.
Oh, I love that. Now, I don't think I've mentioned, but you and I have known each other a good 7 years or so, right about.
Yeah, you were one of the first I met when I came here, so.
That's right. You and I actually both, so I'm from the D.C. area, but I lived in California for about 5 years, and I came back to the D.C. area right around the same time you came to the D.C. area, I mm-hmm. think, around 2009 or so. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the reason that I bring that up is because I think you and I really like to talk about the creative economy here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another reason why I really love what you're doing. And I'm not just huffing you all up here, I'm also, certainly I'm giving you kudos, but I'm also thinking that for people in other cities, marketers, I think if they're not already creative, they have a fondness for creativity. Mm-hmm. And this is a good example of how we can be a magnet, a gravitational pull, and a center for creatives and extra creative experimentation, which I think is a beautiful and important thing.
Yeah, I think, as we talk about this social age, this content age that we're in, it's a really interesting opportunity for artists, because there's a lot of starving artists out there, that have had a hard time monetizing what they make. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say that, doing content for advocacy is art. It's not. But it's still a good venue for their skills and their talents and a way for them to monetize their talents while they're also still working on their art on the side. And I think that of all industries right now, marketing is probably the best opportunity artists have of monetizing their skills. And if we break out of this mindset of trying to do like the way these ad agencies are, these big, large agencies that are really accounts heavy, and then they outsource to another agency, and then they outsource to another. If we can break out of that and become a little bit more nimble, a little bit more gig focused, you talk about the gig economy and where we're heading with that. I think there's an opportunity for all these different artists to have consistent work working with different agencies or working directly with clients. And that's something I'd recommend to, if you have any clients listening to this, and that like you don't always have to go through an agency. Sometimes you can find that freelance talent to work with you, or you can recommend it if you're working with an agency. Say, hey, can we find like a freelancer that we can bring in to work? Because there's no reason to have all of those layers of overhead when we can keep things a lot more efficient and get more output, more content produced, and then get these artists fed.
Right. Agreed. And it doesn't have to be Fiverr. I have nothing against outsourced and offshore talent, but there's a lot of local great talent in just about, I'm sure, every city on earth.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm all about local, and I don't use Fiverr. That's like when you do that, like especially for like logo design, a lot of times.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Anytime they've ever done like a little bit of like digging on that, people are just reusing, stock vector files and stuff. You're not getting something unique. And for a pure design task like that, a lot of times, that should be part of a bigger picture. Like if you're doing a brand redesign for, don't just buy a logo. Right. Work with somebody to think through all the different aspects of it. But if you're doing content, you're trying to put together like a consistent month-to-month output of content around whether it's marketing your own business or it's in the advocacy world and trying to hit on an issue and fundraise or have people take actions. I definitely think there's a role for building that local freelance community up and being able to go to them for different content output whenever you see those opportunities.
Beautiful. Do you have a mantra or a question that you like to ask yourself to keep yourself inspired?
I think that for me, it's always what's next is the question. And sometimes that's dangerous. You don't want to always be chasing something else without making sure you're good at the basics. So like right now, there's a lot of talk about VR, augmented reality. We're certainly looking into like machine learning and AI because I do think there's a lot of opportunity there. And we are going to do a little bit of R&D on some of that, and spend a little bit of time looking at it. But this content stuff, this video production, this has been around forever.
Right.
But there's still a big need. There's still a mindset shift that needs to occur. So when I say what's next, it doesn't mean chasing the latest futurist trend. It means let's look at what actually needs work, what could be better, and then see what's next within that realm. So that's always the question I ask. We do a lot of website builds. And for me, I'm always like, okay, so what's next in the world of websites? A lot of people are like chasing design trends. I feel like the web's all starting to look the same. I just gave a talk at the User Experience DC conference.
Excellent.
About a month ago.
Okay.
About this, and the web all looks the same. So what can we do about it? And that was the spirit of that talk. I call it cinematic UX. And it was about looking for inspiration in other places. And I said, let's look at the world of film and cinema. I'm a big fan of cinema. Brink actually distributes indie films. That's one of the things we do.
Nice.
We're all kind of rooted in that. And if you like go and look at what filmmakers do in making movies just in the approaches they take to color and composition and movement and direction, any different decisions like that. We could be inspired by that in the work we do with websites. So again, with that question of what's next there, I'm not saying what's the latest technology. I'm just saying, like, how can we evolve our thinking a little bit more? Because we're all starting to look the same right now. And I think some of that was a byproduct of some of the spirit of the social studio, right? Being able to do things quickly, patternizing things. You had frameworks like Bootstrap, which was something Twitter made, which was like a ready-to-go framework for building a website. Mm-hmm. And after that came out, every website looked like the Bootstrap framework because it allowed you to deploy websites quickly.
That's a shame.
Yeah, and I think it's a good thing if you're a one-person entrepreneur trying to just get a website up,
right,
or if you're a small business and you need to get something up quick. But once you start to invest more resources, you shouldn't be spending six figures at an agency to have them produce the same site that Squarespace could have given you for whatever they are, $8 a month, you know?
Right.
And so that asking those questions in every vertical, what's next? How can we change or evolve our thinking is just something that we all should be doing while making sure we avoid just chasing trends.
Beautiful. Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think that, you know, overall, it's when it comes to marketing, things get overcomplicated. There's a lot of BS in our industry, let's face it. You know, I'll come out and say that. And so a lot of people are acting like they're selling a secret sauce. You know, our approach is the best. This approach is the best. What I'm talking about here with the social studio isn't like, I don't really sell the approach as like something that groundbreaking. I'm just saying this is the way it should be. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to execute and we're going to do it well. And I hired a talented team that is going to execute well. And so if you take anything away, I think it should be that everything's about execution. It's not about approaches. It's not about planning. It's not about processes. It's about who's going to do it well and do it consistently and focus on results. And part of that is built into that nimble or flexible approach in that you got to be willing to abandon what you're doing if it's proving not to work and try something else. And so if you're working with any sort of marketing partner, if day one they're selling you a tactic rather than being your partner and actually looking at what you need, that's your first red flag.
Right.
And then if they get you into whatever system they have in place and they just keep you on autopilot for years and years and years without evaluating or changing or trying new things, that's a second red flag. And then if they're not showing results, right, you need to constantly be evaluating on your end. You know, maybe you should be working with other partners if you're not seeing those results, because it should always be about execution. It should always be about results, period.
Absolutely. Excellent. Okay. Well, what is the best place for people to go to learn more about you and to reach you?
So our website's brink.com. That's a website that I feel like looks like a lot of other websites on the web today. So don't call me a hypocrite, please, because I'm aware of it.
I don't think so.
I think you'll like the site. It's a nice site. We get a lot of compliments. And to be fair, we made it like 4 years ago, and a lot more sites look like it now than they did at the time. But yeah, brink.com is always the best place to check us out. We do have, I think, a link to our Vimeo page on there.
I'll have links in the show notes to everything we talked about, so absolutely include that.
Yeah, so the Vimeo is the best place to see some of our video output. You'll see a wide range. You'll see the six-person shoot with the high-end HD 4K cameras we did for the Country of Holland, all the way down to the quick videos, including this one, we'll put up as quick as possible.
Perfect.
That we do in our social studio, so you'll see that range. And then you can always email me, just josh@brink.com.
Excellent. Josh, thanks so much for being on the show, man.
I appreciate it. This was fun.
Absolutely. Perfect. So, sitting here in the Brink Social Studio, I am reminded of this little, I don't know if you want to call it a mantra, so much as an answer that replays in my head once in a while, because people who find out I'm in marketing often ask me, what is the secret to marketing? And I've gotten this question from people who have PhDs and people who are just starting businesses, and they ask it. And what the answer that I've come to be most fond of and find to be most helpful is, the secret is go. The secret is just keep going, keep your momentum going, and keep growing. And I think that there's a huge validation and takeaway that relates to that in this studio, in that we need to be producing rich content and we need to be moving fast and continuing our growth. So with that being said, thank you very much for listening. As always, the show notes can be found on spiralmarketing.com. Cheers, folks.